A Blunder by Anton Chekhov, translated by Constance Garnett. Ilya Sergeyevich Peplov and his wife Kleopatra Petrovna were standing at the door, listening greedily. On the other side, in the little drawing room, a love scene was apparently taking place between two persons. Their daughter, Natashenka, and a teacher of the district school called Shupkin. "He's rising," whispered Peplov, quivering with impatience and rubbing his hands. "Now, Kleopatra, mind, as soon as they begin talking of their feelings, take down the icon from the wall and we'll go in and bless them. We'll catch him. A blessing with an icon is sacred and binding. He can't get out of it if he brought it into court." On the other side of the door, this was the conversation. "Don't go on like that," said Shupkin, striking a match against his checked trousers. "I never wrote you any letters." "I like that, as though I don't know your writing," giggled the girl with an affected shriek, continually peeping at herself in the glass. "I knew it at once. And what a queer man you are. You are a writing master, and you write like a spider. How can you teach writing if you write so badly yourself?" "That means nothing. The great thing in writing lessons is not the hand one writes, but keeping the boys in order. You hit one on the head with a ruler, make another kneel down. Besides, there's nothing in handwriting. Nekrasov was an author, but his handwriting's a disgrace. There's a specimen of it in his collected works. You are not Nekrasov." "Oh, I should love to marry an author. He'd always be writing poems to me."
"I can write you a poem, too, if you like."
"What can you write about?"
"Love. Passion. Your eyes. You'll be crazy when you read it. It would draw a tear from a stone. And if I write you a real poem, will you let me kiss your hand?"
"That's nothing much. You can kiss it now, if you like." Shupkin jumped up and, making sheepish eyes, bent over the fat little hand that smelt of egg soap. "Take down the icon!" Peplov whispered in a fluster, pale with excitement, and buttoning his coat as he prodded his wife with his elbow. "Come along now!" And without a second's delay, Peplov flung open the door. "Children!" he muttered, lifting up his arms and blinking tearfully. "The Lord bless you, my children. May you live, be fruitful, and multiply." And I bless you too," the mamma brought out, crying with happiness. "May you be happy, my dear ones. Oh, you are taking from me my only treasure," she said to Shupkin. "Love my girl. Be good to her." Shupkin's mouth fell open with amazement and alarm. The parent's attack was so bold and unexpected that he could not utter a single word. "I'm in for it. I'm spliced," he thought, going limp with horror. "It's all over with you now, my boy. There's no escape." And he bowed his head submissively, as though to say, "Take me. I'm vanquished." "Blessings on you," the papa went on, and he too shed tears. "Natashenka, my daughter, stand by his side. Kleopatra, give me the icon." But at this point, the father suddenly left off weeping, and his face was contorted with anger. "You ninny," he said angrily to his wife. "You are an idiot. Is that the icon?" "Ah, saints alive!" What had happened? The writing master raised himself and saw that he was saved. In her flutter, the mamma had snatched from the wall the portrait of Lazhetchnikov, the author, in mistake for the icon. Old Peplov and his wife stood disconcerted in the middle of the room, holding the portrait aloft, not knowing what to do or what to say. The writing master took advantage of the general confusion and slipped away. Boys by Anton Chekhov. translated by Constance Garnett.
"Volodya's come," someone shouted in the yard. "Master Volodya's here," bawled Natalia, the cook, running into the dining room. "Oh, my goodness!" The whole Korolyov family, who had been expecting their Volodya from hour to hour, rushed to the windows. At the front door stood a wide sledge with three white horses in a cloud of steam. The sledge was empty, for Volodya was already in the hall, untying his hood with red and chilly fingers. His school overcoat, his cap, his snow boots, and the hair on his temples were all white with frost, and his whole figure from head to foot diffused such a pleasant, fresh smell of the snow that the very sight of him made one want to shiver and say, "Brrr!" His mother and aunt ran to kiss and hug him. Natalia plumped down at his feet and began pulling off his snow boots. His sisters shrieked with delight. The doors creaked and banged, and Volodya's father, in his waistcoat and shirt sleeves, ran out into the hall with scissors in his hand and cried out in alarm, "We were expecting you all yesterday. Did you come all right? Had a good journey? Mercy on us! You might let him say how do you do to his father. I am his father, after all." "Roar! Roar!" barked the huge black dog, Milord, in a deep bass, tapping with his tail on the walls and furniture. For 2 minutes there was nothing but a general hubbub of joy. After the first outburst of delight was over, the Korolyovs noticed that there was, besides their Volodya, another small person in the hall, wrapped up in scarves and shawls and white with frost. He was standing perfectly still in a corner, in the shadow of a big fox-lined overcoat. "Volodya, darling, who is it?" asked his mother in a whisper. "Oh!" cried Volodya. "This is, let me introduce my friend Lentilov, a schoolfellow in the second class. I've brought him to stay with us."
"Delighted to hear it. You're very welcome," the father said cordially. "Excuse me, I've been at work without my coat. Please come in. Natalia, help Mr. Lentilov off with his things. Mercy on us, do turn that dog out. He's unendurable."
A few minutes later, Volodya and his friend Lentilov, somewhat dazed by their noisy welcome and still red from the outside cold, were sitting down to tea. The winter sun, making its way through the snow and the frozen tracery on the window panes, gleamed on the samovar and plunged its pure rays in the tea basin. The room was warm, and the boys felt as though the warmth and the frost were struggling together with a tingling sensation in their bodies.
"Well, Christmas will soon be here," the father said in a pleasant sing-song voice, rolling a cigarette of dark reddish tobacco. "It doesn't seem long since the summer, when Mama was crying at your going, and here you are back again. Time flies, my boy. Before you have time to cry out, old age is upon you. Mr. Lentilov, take some more. Please, help yourself. We don't stand on ceremony."
Volodya's three sisters, Katya, Sonya, and Masha, the eldest was 11, sat at the table and never took their eyes off the newcomer. Lentilov was of the same height and age as Volodya, but not as round-faced and fair-skinned. He was thin, dark, and freckled. His hair stood up like a brush, his eyes were small, and his lips were thick. He was, in fact, distinctly ugly, and if he had not been wearing the school uniform, he might have been taken for the son of a cook. He seemed morose, did not speak, and never once smiled. The little girls, staring at him, immediately came to the conclusion that he must be a very clever and learned person. He seemed to be thinking about something all the time, and was so absorbed in his own thoughts that whenever he was spoken to, he started, threw his head back, and asked to have the question repeated. The little girls noticed that Volodya, who had always been so merry and talkative, also said very little, did not smile at all, and hardly seemed to be glad to be home. All the time they were at tea, he only once addressed his sisters, and then he said something so strange. He pointed to the samovar and said, "In California, they don't drink tea, but gin." He, too, seemed absorbed in his own thoughts, and to judge by the looks that passed between him and his friend Lentilov, their thoughts were the same. After tea, they all went into the nursery. The girls and their father took up the work that had been interrupted by the arrival of the boys. They were making flowers and frills for the Christmas tree out of paper of different colours. It was an attractive and noisy occupation. Every fresh flower was greeted by the little girls with shrieks of delight, even of awe, as though the flower had dropped straight from heaven. Their father was in ecstasies too, and every now and then he threw the scissors on the floor in vexation at their bluntness. The mother kept running into the nursery with an anxious face, asking, "Who's taken my scissors? Ivan Nikolaitch, have you taken my scissors again?" "Mercy on us, I'm not even allowed a pair of scissors," their father would respond in a lachrymose voice, and flinging himself back in his chair, he would pretend to be a deeply injured man, but a minute later he would be in ecstasies again. On his former holidays, Volodya, too, had taken part in the preparations for the Christmas tree, or had been running in the yard to look at the snow mountain that the watchman and the shepherd were building. But this time, Volodya and Lentilov took no notice whatever of the coloured paper, and did not once go into the stable. They sat in the window and began whispering to one another. Then they opened an atlas and looked carefully at a map. "First to Perm," Lentilov said in an undertone. "From there to Tumen, then Tomsk, then Kamchatka. Then the Samoyeds take one over Bering Straits in boats, and then we're in America. There are lots of furry animals there." "And California?" asked Volodya. "California's lower down. We've only got to get to America, and California's not far off, and one can get a living by hunting and plunder." All day long, Lentilov avoided the little girls and seemed to look at them with suspicion. In the evening, he happened to be left alone with them for 5 minutes or so. It was awkward to be silent. He cleared his throat morosely, rubbed his left hand against his right, looked sullenly at Katya, and asked, "Have you read Mayne Reid?"
"No, I haven't. I say, can you skate?"
Absorbed in his own reflections, Lentilov made no reply to this question. He simply puffed out his cheeks and gave a long sigh, as though he were very hot. He looked up at Katya once more and said, "When a herd of bisons stampedes across the prairie, the earth trembles and the frightened mustangs kick and neigh." He smiled impressively and added, "And the Indians attack the trains, too, but worst of all are the mosquitoes and the termites."
"Why, what's that?"
"They're something like ants, but with wings. They bite fearfully."
"Do you know who I am?"
"Mr. Lentilov." "No, I am Monty Homo, the Hawk's Claw, chief of the Ever-Victorious." Masha, the youngest, looked at him, then into the darkness out of the window, and said, wondering, "And we had lentils for supper yesterday." Lentilov's incomprehensible utterances, and the way he was always whispering with Volodya, and the way Volodya seemed now to be always thinking about something instead of playing, all this was strange and mysterious, and the two elder girls, Katya and Sonya, began to keep a sharp lookout on the boys. At night, when the boys had gone to bed, the girls crept to their bedroom door and listened to what they were saying. Ah, what they discovered! The boys were planning to run away to America to dig for gold. They had everything ready for the journey, a pistol, two knives, biscuits, a burning glass to serve instead of matches, a compass, and 4 rubles in cash. They learned that the boys would have to walk some thousands of miles and would have to fight tigers and savages on the road. Then they would get gold and ivory, slay their enemies, become pirates, drink gin, and finally marry beautiful maidens and make a plantation. The boys interrupted each other in their excitement. Throughout the conversation, Lentilov called himself Monty Homo, the Hawk's Claw, and Volodya was my pale-faced brother.
"Mind you don't tell Mama," said Katya as they went back to bed.
Volodya will bring us gold and ivory from America, but if you tell Mama, he won't be allowed to go. The day before Christmas Eve, Lentilov spent the whole day poring over the map of Asia and making notes, while Volodya, with a languid and swollen face that looked as though it had been stung by a bee, walked about the rooms and ate nothing. And once he stood still before the holy image in the nursery, crossed himself, and said, "Lord, forgive me, a sinner. Lord, have pity on my poor unhappy mamma." In the evening he burst out crying. On saying good night, he gave his father a long hug and then hugged his mother and sisters. Katya and Sonya knew what was the matter, but little Masha was puzzled, completely puzzled. Every time she looked at Lentilov, she grew thoughtful and said with a sigh, "When Lent comes, nurse says we shall have to eat peas and lentils." Early in the morning of Christmas Eve, Katya and Sonya slipped quietly out of bed and went to find out how the boys meant to run away to America. They crept to their door. "Then you don't mean to go?" Lentilov was saying angrily. "Speak out. Aren't you going?"
"Oh, dear," Volodya wept softly, "how can I go? I feel so unhappy about Mama."
"My pale-faced brother, I pray you, let us set off. You declared you were going, you egged me on, and now the time comes and you funk it."
I'm not funking it, but I'm sorry for Mama."
"Say once and for all, are you going or are you not?"
"I am going, only wait a little. I want to be at home a little."
"In that case, I will go by myself," Lentilov declared. "I can get on without you. And you wanted to hunt tigers and fight. Since that's how it is, give me back my cartridges." At this, Volodya cried so bitterly that his sisters could not help crying too. Silence followed. "So you're not coming?" Lentilov began again.
I am coming."
"Well, put on your things then." And Lentilov tried to cheer Volodya up by singing the praises of America, growling like a tiger, pretending to be a steamer, scolding him, and promising to give him all the ivory and lions and tigers' skins. And this thin, dark boy, with his freckles and his bristling shock of hair, impressed the little girls as an extraordinary, remarkable person. He was a hero. A determined character who knew no fear, and he growled so ferociously that, standing at the door, they really might imagine there was a tiger or lion inside. When the little girls went back to their room and dressed, Katya's eyes were full of tears, and she said, "Oh, I feel so frightened." Everything was as usual till 2 o'clock, when they sat down to dinner. Then it appeared that the boys were not in the house. They sent to the servants' quarters, to the stables, to the bailiff's cottage. They were not to be found. They sent into the village. They were not there. At tea, too, the boys were still absent, and by supper time, Volodya's mother was dreadfully uneasy and even shed tears. Late in the evening, they sent again to the village. They searched everywhere and walked along the river bank with lanterns. Heavens, what a fuss there was! Next day, the police officer came, and a paper of some sort was written out in the dining room. Their mother cried. All of a sudden, a sledge stopped at the door with 3 white horses in a cloud of steam. "Volodya's come!" someone shouted in the yard. "Master Volodya's here!" bawled Natalia, running into the dining room, and Milord barked his deep bass. "Roo! Roo!" It seemed that the boys had been stopped in the arcade, where they had gone from shop to shop, asking where they could get gunpowder. Volodya burst into sobs as soon as he came into the hall and flung himself on his mother's neck. The little girls, trembling, wondered with terror what would happen next. They saw their father take Volodya and Lentilov into his study, and there he talked to them for a long while. "Is this a proper thing to do?" their father said to them. "I only pray they won't hear of it at school. You would both be expelled." "You ought to be ashamed, Mr. Lentilov, really. It's not at all the thing to do. You began it.
and I hope you will be punished by your parents. How could you? Where did you spend the night? At the station, Lentilov answered proudly. Then Volodya went to bed and had a compress steeped in vinegar on his forehead. A telegram was sent off, and the next day a lady, Lentilov's mother, made her appearance and bore off her son. Lentilov looked morose and haughty to the end, and he did not utter a single word at taking leave of the little girls. But he took Katya's book and wrote in it as a souvenir, Monte Homo, the Hawk's Claw, Chief of the Ever-Victorious. The Huntsman by Anton Chekhov. Translation by Constance Garnett. A sultry, stifling midday. Not a cloudlet in the sky. The sun-baked grass had a disconsolate, hopeless look. Even if there were rain, it could never be green again. The forest stood silent, motionless, as though it were looking at something with its treetops, or expecting something. At the edge of the clearing, a tall, narrow-shouldered man of 40 in a red shirt, in patched trousers that had been a gentleman's, and in high boots, was slouching along with a lazy, shambling step. He was sauntering along the road. On the right was the green of the clearing, on the left a golden sea of ripe rye stretched to the very horizon. He was red and perspiring, a white cap with a straight jockey peak, evidently a gift from some open-handed young gentleman, perched jauntily on his handsome, flaxen head. Across his shoulder hung a game bag with a black cock lying in it. The man held a double-barreled gun cocked in his hand and screwed up his eyes in the direction of his lean old dog, who was running on ahead, sniffing the bushes. There was stillness all round, not a sound. Everything living was hiding away from the heat.
Yegor Vlasich!
The huntsman suddenly heard a soft voice. He started and, looking round, scowled. Beside him, as though she had sprung out of the earth, stood a pale-faced woman of 30 with a sickle in her hand. She was trying to look into his face and was smiling diffidently.
"Oh, it's you, Pelagia," said the huntsman, stopping and deliberately uncocking the gun. "How have you come here?"
"The women from our village are working here, so I've come with them. As a labourer, Yegor Vlasich."
Growled Yegor Vlasich, and slowly walked on.
Pelagia followed him. They walked in silence for 20 paces. "I've not seen you for a long time, Yegor Vlasich," said Pelagia, looking tenderly at the huntsman's moving shoulders. "I've not seen you since you came into our hut at Easter for a drink of water. You came in at Easter for a minute, and then, God knows how, drunk, you scolded and beat me and went away. I've been waiting and waiting. I've tired my eyes out looking for you. Oh, Yegor Vlasich, Yegor Vlasich, you might look in just once."
"What is there for me to do there?"
"Of course there's nothing for you to do, though to be sure there is the place to look after, to see how things are going. You are the master. I say you've shot a blackcock, Yegor Vlasich. You ought to sit down and rest." As she said all this, Pelagia laughed like a silly girl and looked up at Yegor's face. Her face was simply radiant with happiness.
"Sit down, if you like," said Yegor, in a tone of indifference, and he chose a spot between two fir trees. "Why are you standing? You sit down, too."
Pelagia sat a little way off in the sun, and, ashamed of her joy, put her hand over her smiling mouth. 2 minutes passed in silence.
"You might come for once," said Pelagia.
"What for?" sighed Yegor, taking off his cap and wiping his red forehead with his hand. "There's no object in my coming. To go for an hour or two is only a waste of time. It's simply upsetting you. And to live continually in the village my soul could not endure. You know yourself I'm a pampered man. I want a bed to sleep in, good tea to drink, and refined conversation. I want all the niceties. While you live in poverty and dirt in the village, I couldn't stand it for a day. Suppose there were an edict that I must live with you. I should either set fire to the hut or lay hands on myself. From a boy, I've had this love for ease.
There's no help for it. Where are you living now?
With the gentleman here, Dmitri Ivanich, as a huntsman. I furnish his table with game, but he keeps me, more for his pleasure than anything.
That's not proper work you're doing, Yegor Vlasic. For other people it's a pastime, but with you it's like a trade, like real work.
You don't understand, you silly, said Yegor, gazing gloomily at the sky. You have never understood, and as long as you live you will never understand what sort of man I am. You think of me as a foolish man, gone to the bad. But to anyone who understands, I am the best shot there is in the whole district. The gentry feel that, and they have even printed things about me in a magazine. There isn't a man to be compared with me as a sportsman. And it's not because I'm pampered and proud that I look down upon your village work. From my childhood, you know, I have never had any calling apart from guns and dogs. If they took away my gun, I used to go out with a fishing hook. If they took the hook, I caught things with my hands. And I went in for horse dealing, too. I used to go to the fairs when I had the money. And you know that if a peasant goes in for being a sportsman, or a horse dealer, it's goodbye to the plough. Once the spirit of freedom has taken a man, you will never root it out of him. In the same way, if a gentleman goes in for being an actor, or for any other art, he will never make an official or a landowner. You're a woman. You don't understand. But one must understand that.
I understand, Yegor Vlasic.
You don't understand if you're going to cry.
I'm not crying, said Pelagia, turning away. It's a sin, Yegor Vlasic. You might stay a day with luckless me anyway. It's 12 years since I was married to you, and there has never once been love between us. I'm not crying.
Love, muttered Yegor, scratching his hand. There can't be any love. It's only in name we are husband and wife. We aren't really. In your eyes, I'm a wild man, and in mine, you're a simple peasant woman with no understanding. Are we well matched?
I am a free, pampered, profligate man, while you are a working woman, going in bark shoes and never straightening your back. The way I think of myself is that I am the foremost man in every kind of sport, and you look at me with pity. Is that being well matched?
But we are married, you know, Yegor Vlasic, sobbed Pelagia. Not married of our free will. Have you forgotten? You have to thank Count Sergei Pailovich and yourself out of envy, because I shot better than he did. The Count kept giving me wine for a whole month. And when a man's drunk, you could make him change his religion, let alone getting married. To pay me out, he married me to you when I was drunk. A huntsman to a herd girl. You saw I was drunk. Why did you marry me? You were not a serf, you know. You could have resisted. Of course, it was a bit of luck for a herd girl to marry a huntsman. But you ought to have thought about it. Well, now, be miserable. Cry.